I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham and this week I'm joined by Irena Musumeci.
Hello.
Hello. And this week we are going to be talking about Daphne, which arrives in cinemas and on demand today. If you're listening to this on Friday or whenever you're listening to it, it'll be available however you want to watch it. But Irena, first of all, what have you been watching?
What have I been watching? So this week I have caught up with the latest season of Transparent, which is currently one of my favorite series to watch. It's it follows the life of a family, kind of fairly wealthy Jewish family in contemporary LA. And if you've been watching from series one, you will know that in the very first episode, the paterfamilias, daddy, who is a an academic, a sociologist, in his late 60s, I believe, decides to come out as trans to his entire family. Hence the title of the series, Transparent. Aha. It's a brilliant study of family relations, but also of gender and everything attached to it. It really kind of explores so many different iterations of things that are related to the idea of transitioning in a very kind of open, very contemporary way, very fresh way. But it also resonates with, I think, anybody who has trouble relating to their families or their family history. And I'm enjoying this latest season. I've not got to the end of it yet. Yeah. But it's fun.
I understand this one goes on a bit of a, I wouldn't say holiday, but more of a travelogue.
There's definitely travel involved. There are journeys of all kinds. And the family does take a trip to Israel to kind of discover a bit more about where they came from and where they might be headed next, much as in every cinematic journey. A lot of it is set in Israel, and it's quite well woven into the politics of the series as well, how they deal with the existence of Israel and its sort of contradictions and complications. I think it's remarkable in its empathy as a series. And it really does take in quite a lot of what's going on in the world today. So it's very, very enjoyable. I highly recommend it.
Excellent. I think it was one of those weird ones where I absolutely loved it when I was watching it and just haven't watched the rest of it. And I've seen the first two seasons.
That's a shame. I found myself completely addicted. I started watching the first season and I just couldn't wait for the next ones. So when this one came on, I think it was last Friday, I just kind of binged on it. And I've got one episode left and I had to stop myself because I thought, oh, really, I just have to savor it a bit more. So
you should do what Eric Banner and his wife do. So they, when they binge stuff, they will watch something. And then when there's a cliffhanger or the end of an episode or just any episode, they think, well, if we don't know, we're never going to be able to go to sleep. So they watch the first 5 minutes of the next episode and then go to sleep and pause it there.
Yeah, that seems sensible.
It's a good system.
I'm not going to ask you, how do you know what Eric Bana and his wife do?
Oh, we just often chat sometimes.
Fair enough. Yeah.
I like to keep updated with him.
One of the highlights of my life is being with you, actually, on the night Rebecca Miller revealed that Daniel Day-Lewis really enjoys watching Vikings.
So that, I don't think I'll ever top that as a scoop.
Me neither. It was probably the highlight of all Q&As ever.
Excellent. What I've been watching this week is actually, well, I say watch many things, but one particular thing is John Crowley's film Brooklyn, which is a film that I had the fear, where you know after you watch something and you love it and you're scared to watch it again in case you don't love it.
Yeah.
And I was not expecting to like Brooklyn, actually, when I first watched it. And it really took me by surprise and just like completely fell for it and read the book and was so into this film. But I weirdly couldn't bring myself to watch it again in that it might not be as nice as I remember it, because it was like one of those environmental things where it was cold outside and it might have been in my head it's snowing, and you go into the cinema and you've got this like loving warm firelit film on a December night, and but I just watched it in a pretty rubbish environment on a laptop streaming, and I just loved it, and I still love it, and I'm so pleased to say that I do. It's the film that if I wanted to write something, like if I, like, you know, those BFI classics, like if ever I could think of something that I'd want to write about right now, it would be that film.
Wow.
And I don't fully understand why yet either, but I want to figure that out.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
And what about that feeling? What I really like is the surprise of liking a film on second viewing that you didn't like the first time round, and kind of realizing how wrong you were.
Yeah, definitely.
This happened to me with 2001, A Space Odyssey, which I really couldn't get the first time round. And then to be fair, I did watch it on an Italian TV, small screen, late at night, dubbed into Italian for what little dialogue there is. And then I finally got to see it properly, 70mm BFI screening. And I thought, whoa, okay, I see what all the fuss was about. So definitely, I'm one for rewatching things a lot. Mm. And in fact, I've rewatched Daphne now twice. Mm. And the first time I was very ill, on a lot of painkillers, and I had to watch it on a laptop quite a few months ago now, in summer. And now coming back to it in September, it's really coming to its own. I really liked it at the time as well, but now it just feels like it's the right time of the year for it, and watching it on a cinema screen as well was a great pleasure, a really great surprise.
Mm. It's a very wintry film, actually. I don't know, I can tell you exactly when it's set, but because of, let's get into Daphne, really. Daphne is a chef, so a lot of her lifestyle actually takes place at night. And so we don't see a lot of her daily outings. I mean, it's very much focused on her night activities.
It definitely has a nocturnal feel to it, but it's interesting. I didn't think of it as a winter film. I thought of it as an autumn film. But then you could say that because it's so much of a London film and we have these kind of crazy seasons here that are been nondescript and indistinct. I mean, today I'm wearing a T-shirt. 2 days ago I was wearing a woolly scarf. It does capture the sort of sense of what time of the day is it, what time of the year is it, that you can get in London when you get absorbed into your life on a daily basis. And to me, it really feels like a great London film, you know, in that tradition of certain films that I always associate with the city. Particularly, there's one that's probably my favorite London film, which is Wonderland by Michael Winterbottom, which I think Daphne refers to in quite a lot of different ways that we can go into.
Well, it's not a London film in an international sense. It's not driven by landmarks and hearing London calling on the soundtrack, which is, I think, has been done twice in films this year alone.
Yeah.
I think there's only one wide shot where you could see Canary Wharf. It's an insular London that you it doesn't like force you outside of it. Even if you are watching this in America or something, it's recognizably London without putting you in a tube and putting you on a red bus and getting in a black cab.
Yeah.
It actually feels a lived in London, not a one through a lens.
And there's definitely, though, some landmarks that most contemporary 30-something Londoners will recognise, such as, I think it must be Ridley Road Market at the beginning. There's a lot of Dalston, a lot of kind of East End areas, which are recognisably the kind of the Brooklyn of London, I think. And perhaps the film is very knowingly riffing on things like the settings for girls. I'm thinking of another film that this film kind of put me in the mind of, which is Margaret, right. Which also has this
Kenneth
kind of
Lonergan.
Great, the Kenneth Lonergan film. There's something about the atmosphere of Margaret. Margaret is a film in which was made in New York after 9/11, and it sort of tells, it's a character study, a little bit like Daphne, of a young woman who is a bit cynical, a bit detached from emotions, and then she witnesses this kind of shocking event, which is not a kind of, it's not 9/11, it's not a worldwide shocker, but it's a small, everyday kind of traumatic experience of the kind that can happen to you in a city. And something very similar happens to Daphne. And both films kind of then take this woman on a slight journey, so yeah, to go back to that idea and do something that to them that changes the way they interact with the world. It's not a major earthquake kind of thing, but it's kind of the small earthquake which has deep ripples for me. So the I see a real parallel between Margaret and Daphne, but also Margaret has this kind of non-touristy New York feel to it, in that a Baumbach way as well. So it seems to me that there's certainly a kind of urban subgenre that Daphne is operating in. We haven't really said much about the plot.
Well, that's so all we kind of get given is that Daphne is a chef, but she's in the lower ranks of her kitchen. She's not the kitchen porter. She's, I think, making dressings. I can't remember what the correct name for that is.
I don't know.
She's below the sous chef. I think it's like gravies and... there is a word for it, but I've forgotten. Gravies and dressings and salads and that kind of thing. And I think most of the money that she earns from that kind of... once the rent is paid, it's going on booze. And that seems to be a regular occurrence, probably most nights, getting thrown out of places, oversharing with people that have maybe she've just met. And I think there's a deconstruction of this this kind of early season of Girls, tiny furniture-y identity of the young city woman. And it's touched on, I think, in Gone Girl, weirdly, the idea of the cool girl. And it kind of presents the ingredients of a cool young woman in a city of, oh yeah, she's working in a what looks like a very cool kitchen, and she's going out and she's in nice bars and she's shopping in nice markets and she's buying what looks like a good amount of cheese. And it's then actually deconstructing the recipe for that, and actually that's quite an isolated life. But as a chef, that can actually be really demanding.
It's not all the loneliness of the long-distance chef, though.
No.
There's a lot of sort of scenes, as we were saying, quite nocturnal, set in bars, where she picks up a number of guys. She's very attractive, and she's kind of cool. And I think her cool attitude, of being quite a cynic, doesn't care, not interested in love. She just wants, a kind of fun night with a guy who may or may not bring some drugs, something like that. Something that the film does quite interestingly and quite well for me is not attaching to relationships the idea that that's going to be the key, that's going to save you, that's going to take you out of this loneliness, which I think is, again, quite modern, but quite brave. I don't think girls ever quite went to that place.
We have this character of David, who in any other film that would be described as a romantic comedy, he is ultimately the savior.
Yeah, there's something that reminded me of Appropriate Behavior as well, in the kind of two random strangers meet and they spend a night and something might happen and then nothing happens in a way, and she's able to leave him too. And he's quite needy and clingy. And I found the representation of the guys in the film quite interesting as well. So the first, I think in the very first few scenes, she is hanging out with this guy outside the pub. And he, as they're kissing, he pulls out his phone. And she says, "What are you doing?" And he goes, I'm just taking one for the lads." And he's taking a selfie to show off that he's pulled this girl. So you kind of think, oh God, you know, but we've all met this guy. Mm. If it wasn't a selfie, it was certainly some kind of memento that would be taken back to show to the lads. And like him, there's quite a few guys who are just sort of a bit too much, but not in a kind of, again, full-on threatening way, more in a sort of, I don't really know what to do kind of way.
Yeah.
And then there's this really interesting relationship between Daphne and her boss, who at one point does say, "I'm in love with you, you know that." And yet he has a family and he's not able to do anything about it, but he seems to be really generally caring. And he's the one who kind of tells her to shut up and put an end to it, or just kind of, he's the one who kicks her out when she's misbehaving and really puts her into her place. And there's a feeling that something like a relationship against the odds might develop, and it never does. And I actually really admire the film for it, because life is not like that. You may be deeply in love with somebody, but they have a family, and it's not possible to run off and make everything perfect just because someone said that they love you. So I thought it was quite a quite an unusual and quite a realistic portrait of a certain life. That made sense to me.
And I think there are some nice little jabs at the trope of the stalker man of rom-coms as well, and your Ryan Gosling's in La La Land, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think that there's this character of David kind of references, like,
normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Making multiple phone calls or running after her, and she just flips him a finger, and it's great.
Yeah.
Actually, it's really this nice rejection, and it's this self-ownership that is ultimately the journey. Like, the relationship that she's trying to find is with herself.
Yes. There's also, you mentioned Ryan Gosling, I've just remembered a really
good film
where she's trying to feed him. Is it fried chicken?
Yeah, so she's drunk, buys a bucket of fried chicken and sits in front of a computer just going, "Do you want some chicken, Ryan Gosling?" And just pushing this, and you can see the bits of chicken breaking apart on the screen and it's all flaky and greasy.
It also all fits into Daphne's perception and point of view, that love is just an illusion to bind us all together so we will all propagate the species, which she takes from her numerous and continuous reading and fandom of Slavoj Žižek.
Yes.
Which is also one of those tropes of kind of millennial Londoners, millennial people in the world who are influenced by kind of popular philosophy and critical theory as a mode of operating in the world.
But she does call him a donut as well.
Which, you know, to be fair,
yeah.
Slavoj Žižek,
there
you go.
She also says that whenever I do coke, I think about Freud.
Of course, but who doesn't? But it's funny also that these jabs are kind of, you know, I read critical theory, but I don't believe in psychoanalysis. All kind of comes out in the wash when she's going to see the psychotherapy that has been allocated to her by the is it the victim support program? Yeah. So when this particular event happens in Daphne's life, she has to call the police, and she's involved in this, as we mentioned, shocking event that we're not going to reveal fully. But as a result of this, she's then put through the mechanism of the British police system, and she gets a phone call from the victim support officer, who refers her to a psychotherapist who is there to help her with any kind of trauma that she might have had from it. And now, because the event itself wasn't this cataclysmic thing that you feel you might need to go into therapy for, initially this relationship and this having to go and see the therapist feels like another kind of comedy setup. And the first time she just kind of walks off on him going, you're not going to analyze me, I don't need this crap. And then, of course, at some point she does go back to him because she realizes that she can actually do with a conversation with someone who is outside all of it. And he seems to be the person who says to her, you know, you can live in a different way. It's possible if you just let things in a little bit more. And that's, you know, she then says to him, oh, that's surprisingly good advice.
Yeah.
And it is. And it's also quite unexpected, because there I was expecting the kind of the psychiatrist thing to turn into comedy again, and to turn into this kind of Woody Allen-esque, oh, doctor, what does this mean? And it doesn't. And he says something really valuable to her, which is that sometimes, even if you feel disconnected from things, you can still act on them, and you can still do something that is the right thing, and it matters. Your actions count, and they may not count here and now in the moment to you, but maybe one day they will. Maybe something that you have decided to act on today will have ripples later on. And that small but very, very precious thing is what really made the film for me, because it's not conventional kind of realization, oh God, my life must change, but it does make her do something very small for her mother, which probably means an awful lot to the mother, doesn't mean very much to her, and yet she's incredibly moved by the end of it.
Well, there's this value in put in little actions, and there's a meal at the end that's actually really lovely to watch. And I think this idea of food as a creator of communal spaces is really nice, and that she's been a chef and effectively been always on the outside of that. That she's a feeder, and she's giving this goodness and this conversation and this life to people in her work. And then when you see her eat at home, she gets takeaway in. She goes and buys a bucket of chicken and eats it by herself. And come the end of the film, you see her in this environment where she's actually sitting around a table. And for one reason or another, she can't actually engage properly in the conversation. And it's more about just the fact that she's sharing this experience with someone. It feels really lovely.
Yeah, I think there's also tiny details, like, for example, the times when she's cooking for herself, which you would think, oh, probably she doesn't put any effort into it, but she does make herself a really nice meal once. And then there's another time when she makes something and then she just chucks it in the bin. So there's certainly some kind of narrative related to the idea of what you get out of it, what nourishment do you get out of, well, obviously specifically food, but given that she is a chef, there's a great symbolic meaning to it. I wanted to go back to the scene with the delivery boy, because that's something that actually made me giggle, in that there's a great representation of multiculturalism in London, but also there's a kind of comedy about it. So this guy turns up with her takeaway, and she kind of goes, oh, you know, I haven't got enough cash, I'm kind of, you know, I'm 2 quid short, but I'm good for it, it's fine, off you go, God is great. And he goes, yeah, I'm not Muslim, thank you. And he goes, whatever. And he's kind of used to it, and you think that's sort of a little throwaway joke, but it's at the same time made fun of that sort of knowingness, oh yeah, I'm going to be friendly and I'll make a comment, but it's completely misplaced and out of order, really.
Yeah.
But he just kind of goes, yeah, whatever. He's totally used to it. So that's something that I found really unproblematized in a way, because it's also part of London living, and that there's, you know, all kinds of different people, which is great.
Also, really good swearing.
Really good swearing, yes. And swearing with gusto as well, like properly delivered.
This is like a level close to Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast amount of swearing. I would love to, but someone calls someone a cheesy little something and it's delivered in such a way. It's just fantastic.
Well, there's something very magical about English swearing as well, which I think is
It got me thinking of the kind of the New York films we were comparing this to. And I don't know if you ever get kind of swearing in those films in the same way.
They just don't curse, but yeah, they don't really. There's not that sort of sophistication.
There's more, and there's an annoyance and a frustration in that. In cursing, but this is just it's like pure emotion and anger just being let rip in three words. It's fantastic to hear.
I don't think I can't think of a British film that does the same kind of work as Daphne. It feels to me like it's really riffing on these American things, which is quite an interesting sort of new influence, and yet it does feel very much in this kind of moment for British cinema, don't you think? Or is that something that I'm sort of seeing retrospectively, perhaps? Because we've had Lady Macbeth, we've had God's Own Country, and it feels like there's quite a lot of new, fresh British voices coming to the fore. So the director of Daphne is a debut filmmaker, Peter Mackie Burns, scriptwriter, I think he's also Londoner, but he may be Italian. And the producer's Italian, which is also quite interesting.
Because I think she mentions at some point that that's her heritage as well, isn't it? She's English-Italian.
Yeah, but there's this sort of, you know, fresh kind of sense of Britishness and British voices in British cinema.
I think a lot of the time, maybe English independent cinema can get divided down the middle in that it's going to be kind of a stuffy period drama or it's going to be Ken Loach, and there's not actually any middle ground in between, and maybe that's the area that we're seeing more films being made in.
Yeah, because I think definitely, certainly these three films, I mean, Lady Macbeth is a period drama only insofar as it has costumes in it and is set in the past, and God's Own Country is not anywhere in the sort of kind of straightforward social realism, but much more in a kind of Andrea Arnold sense of where you can tell a realistic story about a real place with much more depth to it than simply the observational, which
there's,
I think...
There's maybe a bit more hope coming around. Like, if that's what we... I think maybe that's what a lot of the time when you see stuff parodied, it's like BBC Four, and it's just like... Condensation, the documentary, and just very deadpan serious drama or documentary about working class life, and isn't everything hopeless and no one's going anywhere, and that, I think in the like Lady Macbeth, although it's quite dark, it's a very empowering film as well. And it's quite
did you find Daphne a kind of, as a man, did you find Daphne an empowering film for women, or what did you think?
I think,
sorry to put you on the spot.
I think in the end I did. I think it did actually, I think it had issues with her reliance on relationships and how valuable those relationships were to her and how destructive they were, but I think ultimately it had to show them for us to realize that they're no good, and that there is this idea of like taking ownership for yourself and your body and doing what you want to do, but ultimately realizing that there is a danger in that. And I think there is, some issues in some of the relationships that he had, but then come the journey that she's gone on by the end of the film, that's justified.
Yeah. Well, I do think that the lack of moralization of her sexual promiscuity, if we want to see it that way, is really good. I think, you know, she's free to pick up guys, do whatever she likes. And what's problematized is very much the kind of human connections that go with that. It's not so much the fact that she may be sleeping with this guy one night and another one the next night. And I found that really quite, as I said, refreshing and really quite empowering and very contemporary. You know, we shouldn't be here saying, oh, isn't that good that they did that? It's very much what I see most of my friends do, or rather what I used to see most of my friends do, because I'm slightly older. But yeah, there's certainly, I think the point of view of this film is quite it's quite feminist in a sort of positive and interesting way, and I really appreciated that. I also really loved the opening credits.
The title card.
Yeah, the title cards. And I really like that shot where she's kind of going down the escalator, and you see her face reflected into a tiny little fragment.
I'd like to think it was intentional. I think there's some real graduate moments.
Yeah.
And there's, at the start, she's sitting amongst all these tropical plants, which I thought, like, that's the hotel. And then you've got this graduate, it's the airport shot or the Jackie Brown shot.
Yes.
And I think that is the escalator as well. And
exactly.
That's a very similar journey that we're going on here, but ultimately with perhaps a better ending.
Yes. And the graduate also has that kind of thread through it. What are you going to do with your life? What are you going to, now you're a grown up. What are you supposed to do? And I think that's very much a kind of core question in Daphne. And what I really found empowering was that she finds the answer to that herself.
Yeah.
And she doesn't find it in anybody else.
And I think what's of the millennial generation is that point in your life where you are meant to be asking yourself that question is coming later and later. Mm. And people are having that ability to ask themselves that question later and later. And it's, you don't know whether or not whether it's just been a delay tactic, but actually I do kind of get the impression that career wise she is actually in the nice position of knowing exactly what she loves. And it's quite nice that that's not actually part of the drama in a way, that this is more of a social thing, and it's about finding her place in the world outside of work, which is so often the question that we're given in these films, as with The Graduate, the what you want to do with your life, that's directed purely at work.
Yeah. I think that's changed socially, hasn't it? And that today work isn't the only thing that you can do or should do. There is so much pressure to make sure that people are fulfilled in all kinds of different ways. You know, you're meant to have a good relationship, and you're meant to have a house, and you're meant to have kids, and you're meant to have this and that. And so, where things may once have followed one from the other, i.e. you have a job, then eventually you'll get married and you settle down and you buy a house and you have kids, things are happening at slightly different times today. And I think that's really reflected in this film, and that's why I think I found it so recognizable. And I think it did a very, very good job.
And it's not like it sews everything up.
Yeah.
It's more left to maybe close a few things emotionally to open up a lot more pathways.
Yes, so we're ready for Daphne 2, the sequel.
Yes, Electric Boogaloo. we must end there. If you do want to watch Daphne, it is Curzon Cinemas now. It's also on Curzon Home Cinema, so do check out both of those. Watch it however you like. Watch it in the cinema, and then on Curzon Home Cinema.
Watch it twice.
Yeah, do stick around next week because we're going to interview Kate Taylor, one of the programmers of the London Film Festival, to talk about the eclectic range of films that are going to be playing in the city, as well as some of the Curzon Artificial Eye films that will be playing too. And you can look forward to a few London Film Festival specials where we've got a lot of interviews and a roundup as well coming over the next few weeks. So I look forward to you joining us for that. Until next time, it's goodbye from Arena.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.